Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth by Robert C. Newman. Abstract, a proposed model for harmonizing the biblical and scientific data regarding the origin and early history of the Earth is given here as sketched in my book Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth. When we think about the question of the origin of the Earth, recent advances have aided our understanding in this area. There's been a big breakthrough in optical telescopes in recent years, producing much, much larger reflectors than previously. We've, of course, had the space probes, which have allowed us to pick up information from above our atmosphere. Computer power has improved substantially as well, and we now have some better techniques for detecting planets. Up until about 15 years ago, there were some hints of maybe some planets, but nothing very definite. And in the past 15 years, we've now discovered some 100 planets or so. The techniques we have for discovering them strongly favor large planets, so that's largely what we've discovered, and also favor planets very close to their stars, and that's what we have typically discovered. As a result, we now have considerable evidence for testing theories regarding the origin of the Earth. The other item of our title here is Genesis 1. Well, the Bible was written over 2,000 years ago, when humans had no way to study the universe like we do now. Can such a book really tell us anything about the Earth's origin? Well, the Bible claims to come from Earth's creator, and the creator ought to know if anyone does, huh? We're going to look here at, first of all, scientific data, and then we'll come back at biblical data, and then we'll think a little bit about some model making. So first of all, scientific data. It turns out that some of the data that is significant in thinking through how the Earth might have been formed relate to the mass distribution of our Sun and its solar system, the distribution of angular momentum within the same system, the shape of the orbits that we find in the objects orbiting our Sun, and the alignment of these orbits. On top of these things, the chemical composition of the planets seems to give us some clues as well. Let's have a look at these. Mass distribution. The mass in our solar system is not evenly distributed. It's hard to show a picture of mass distribution, but here's a picture at the lower right here of the sizes of the various objects in our solar system. The Sun doesn't really fit on this picture, and so we just showed the edge of it there on the left. And then to the right side, we show the orange edge of Jupiter and the purple, I suppose, or something, edge of Saturn, the brown edge of Uranus, and the pink edge of Neptune. And then the other objects are small enough to see the whole shape of, if you like. And we show Earth, Venus, Mars, Ganymede, Titan, Mercury, etc. Well, with the Sun being as big as it is, and although it's somewhat less dense than a few of the inner planets, the upshot is that most of the mass in our solar system is concentrated in the Sun. The distribution is actually that the Sun has 750 parts, and the rest of the solar system has one part. So virtually all the mass concentrated in the Sun. Angular momentum, secondly, and perhaps we should say a word about what angular momentum is. Most people have some feel for what momentum is, by which we mean linear momentum. Linear momentum is a tendency to keep moving, if you like, in a straight line. And we see it perhaps in football, when we think of a heavier and a lighter player coming through the line. If they're moving at the same speed, the heavier player will have considerably more momentum. The momentum is the mass of the person times their velocity, if you like. Well, linear momentum is tendency to move in a straight line. Angular momentum is tendency to keep rotating, if you like. And we see that with a figure skater. Both linear and angular momentum depend on an object's speed and its mass. Both kinds need force to change them. The angular momentum of the solar system is also not evenly distributed, but it's quite different than the mass distribution. The angular momentum is largely out in the planets, if you like. The Sun has one part, and the planets have 200 parts of the angular momentum. Much of this is due to the fact that the Sun is very close into the center of rotation, which is kind of at the center of the Sun, and it's just spinning around it. But the planets are quite a ways away from that. And in angular momentum, we not only have the mass and the speed of the object involved in the momentum, but also its distance from the center of rotation. The planetary orbits move in nearly circular, the planets move in nearly circular orbits rather than elongated ones. They all go around the Sun in the same direction as well. And their orbital planes nearly coincide with that of the Sun's equator. Most of them within just a few percent of that. The ones furthest off that alignment are Mercury on the inside and Saturn and Pluto on the outside. So this is what we've got. We've got mass of our planetary system, of our solar system, concentrated at the center at the Sun. The angular momentum spread out and largely in the outer parts of the solar system. And so we have to think about how that situation came about. In most objects, most astronomical objects, thinking of stars and planets and things of that sort, the angular momentum and the mass are fairly similarly distributed, but in our solar system and probably in other planetary systems as well, it is not. The planets in our system are moving in nearly circular orbits rather than the elongated ones. They're all going around the Sun in the same direction, and that direction, by the way, corresponds to the way that the Sun itself is rotating, and their orbital planes nearly coincide with that of the Sun's equator. Chemical composition. The planets have the same elements as the Sun and the Earth, but we have rather different proportions scattered among the different objects in our solar system. The inner planets form one group. They are small, and they are heavy, dense, and they're made up of materials that are largely rather non-volatile, what we think of as metals and rocks of one sort or another. The outer planets form another group. They are rather large, and they are rather light for their size, rather low density, and they're made up of material that's much more volatile. So we have this rather distinct thing there as well. So it's these sort of things that we need to explain somehow then in a model that is going to basically reconstruct for us the origin of the solar system. Well, scientific models have been proposed. One model, which was popular for a long time, up until the 50s even of this past century, is a random capture model. It's also picked up by a number of picked up by a number of spectacular popularizers. Immanuel Velikovsky, Donald Patton are proponents of this kind of model. The idea here is that the planets formed elsewhere and they were captured by the Sun. the picture would be somewhat like that in the science fiction novel from the 1930s by Balmer and Wiley, When Worlds Collide. This kind of capture situation, random capture sort of thing, will typically give randomly oriented non-circular orbits to the planets after they're captured, and would take something, some other mechanism then to try and circularize or put these orbits in a equatorial plane as we actually find them. The picture would be rather like the kind of a common picture we have of an atom, where the electrons are picture this kind of planets going around the nucleus, which is the sun, but they're going around in all sorts of directions and at all sorts of angles. A second model is close approach models. Model was in fact the dominant model perhaps for the first half of the 20th century. Some of the proponents are Chamberlain, Moulton, Sir James Jeans. The idea here was a near collision between stars, and tidal forces then pulled out gas from each of the stars, and this gas then and dust would have condensed to form planets, is the idea. This, by the way, will give us orbits of the planets that are in the same plane as the orbit of, as the plane of the collision, if you like, and that likely would be the plane of the rotation of the stars by the time the collision was over. However, the orbits will not be circular, and it is not likely that this will actually form planets, since you're pulling very hot material out of the stars, and it's rather quickly then moving out into an area where the gravity is low and is likely much more likely to disperse than to form planets. In any case, this would make planets very, very rare. At a time when we really did not have any good idea how common or rare planets might be, this perhaps would be as good a model in some ways as the model we will be looking at in a moment. It rather clearly predicts that planets will be rare, and we now know that planets are fairly common. So that is a rather serious problem. The model which has now come to dominate planetary studies is actually a pretty old one. It goes back to Kant and Laplace back around 1800, but was revived after World War II by Gould and Hoyle and others. It's called a star formation model, and there's some varieties to this. But in this kind of a model, planets are natural byproducts of star formation. They're not something that stars somehow pick up wandering objects that are out in space, nor are they something that are due to the close approach of two stars to one another, close enough to gravitationally pull material off of each star. Rather, they're a natural byproduct of star formation. This model is the one that's generally favored today. It naturally explains, as we will see, the features of the mass being concentrated at the center, the angular momentum at the outside of the system, the orbits being coplanar with the rotation of the star itself and being nearly circular and being in the same direction as the rotation of the star. And it also can explain the compositional situation in which the composition of the outer planets is more volatile material and such, and they're bigger, and the inner planets tend to be smaller and less volatile material. And in fact, you get a situation in which the composition of the outer planets and the composition of the sun are fairly close to one another, and the composition of the inner planets are rather different. It also predicts that planets will be relatively common, and as I pointed out, that is now known to be the case. Well, we're going to examine this model in some detail. This model starts with a gas cloud. Spiral galaxies have gas and dust clouds in them. Spiral galaxies are characterized by having the stars form in them over a large part of the history of the galaxy, rather than, as with ellipticals, all forming rather near the beginning of the history of the galaxy. These gas clouds contain mostly hydrogen and helium, and in the case of our particular gas cloud, and probably gas clouds that are going to form any planets, something on the order of 1% or so heavier elements, which would include the various silicates and iron and silicon and iron and the such, as well as carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and such, heavier elements in the form of dusts and ices. These clouds are normally very diffuse, just a few atoms per cubic centimeter, and therefore a better vacuum than we can actually make on Earth yet. Some of these clouds would be rather hot, around 1,000 degrees absolute, 1,000 degrees Kelvin. Others would be rather cold, only around 100 degrees Kelvin, which is, you may remember, is then going to be nearly 200 degrees below zero Celsius. Sometimes a gas cloud will begin to collapse. We think that one reason this may occur is that the cloud is in a state that's fairly, what shall we say, in equilibrium regarding collapse, and then a shock wave of some sort hits it and compresses part of it, and the compression then produces stronger gravity there, and the gas cloud begins to collapse. Cooler, denser clouds are more likely to collapse than the hotter ones are, obviously. A jolt of some sort, as I mentioned, may start it. Once the cloud begins to collapse, it will typically continue unless some external event disrupts it in one way or another. Such a gas cloud will eventually begin to manifest rotation. Random motions in the cloud will tend to cancel, leaving only the movement of the cloud through space and its rotation. And then as the cloud continues to collapse, the rotation will be highly magnified as the collapse continues. You remember we spoke a moment ago about angular momentum and gave the picture of the ice skater there. An ice skater will sometimes spin around as a part of the person's act, if you like, and a way of slowing down or speeding up the spin can be done by the skater pulling her arms inward, and she will spin faster, or putting them out, she will spin slower. Basically, that involves conservation of angular momentum. Well, as this cloud collapses, it'd be like the skater pulling her arms in, and the rotation goes faster, except we're going to get an enormously large change in the size of the cloud, which will enormously change the rotation. The upshot of this is that the gas cloud, which is perhaps rather shapeless to start with, will become perhaps more spherical as the cloud begins to collapse, but then as it collapses more and more, and as the rotation is magnified, the cloud will move towards the shape of more of a pancake shape unless other forces intervene. So here the pictures to the right show you the cloud collapsing and then its shape changing towards a kind of a pancake shape. Other forces will get involved as well. We've got gravity pulling in, and we've got the temperature producing a gas pressure pushing out, and we've got the rotation, and that will produce a little bit different kind of an outward push than the pressure, an outward push along the equator and not an outward push along the poles, if you like. If the rotation is too fast, the cloud will typically split, forming two or more stars, and as a result, probably few or no planets. Planets are less likely to form around a multi-star system than around a single-star system. As the cloud collapses, it will get hotter and denser, especially near its center, and this will eventually cause the gas to ionize. That is, the temperature of the gas will get high enough that the collisions of the gas molecules will rip electrons off, and you now get a situation which you've got the negative electrons, negatively charged electrons, moving around the positively charged ions. And this brings in an additional force besides gravitation, the gas pressure, and the centrifugal force. It will add in the force of electromagnetism. This new force is going to split the cloud into two regimes, a central bulge, which will eventually collapse to form the sun, and a band, which will be pushed out and will form the planets. Magnetic forces will connect these two regions, and the magnetic forces will basically result in transferring angular momentum from the central bulge, that is the sun, to the outer band, that is the planets. And so here's how you get then the situation in which the mass is concentrated at the center of the solar system, and the angular momentum is dispersed to the outer part of the solar system. As the outer band picks up angular momentum, it moves away from the center and cools. The various chemicals condense out. The non-volatile chemicals condense out in close to where the sun is going to be, where it is still is already hot, and the volatiles condense out further out, and you then get this chemical separation that we find in our planetary system. This band is going to form the planets, and it's going to be rotating in the same direction as the sun, and it's going to be rotating in fairly circular orbits, other things being equal. So, formation of planets. These little infinitesimal planets, which we call planetesimals, will collide and adhere to form larger objects. As the objects get larger and larger, they gradually sweep up all the solid materials in their region, and the final collisions between much larger objects are rather violent. This produces the irregularities in orbits and rotation that we actually see in our solar system. There's reason to believe that the last really big collision in connection with our Earth was when our Earth was struck by an object about the size of Mars that knocked off a great deal of material that formed our moon and greatly thinned down the crust of our planet Earth. The inner planets are formed from close-in material, so less volatile material, and there's less of this, so these planets are small. The outer planets are formed from the outer materials, which are more volatile, and there's more of this, so the planets are larger. We believe that the planets form basically cold. Obviously, there's some collisional heat, but they heat up from radioactivity and from their mounting gravitational pressure, producing high temperatures inside, and the collisions. And the collisions will keep things on the surface rather hot until they finally quit, if you like. Formation of atmospheres. The outer planets collect gases from nearby. The inner planets, however, lose this sort of gas due to the heat of the sun, and perhaps the solar wind as well from the sun, and due to the fact that they have less gravity. The inner planets, we think, got their atmosphere from inside as the planet heats up and loses the volatiles originally absorbed on dust and gas grains, dust and ice grains. So a review of the star formation model. A shapeless, empty gas cloud begins to collapse. It becomes hotter and denser as it collapses. Rotation makes the cloud flatten. Ionization splits the cloud into a flat band and a rounded center. The band gains angular momentum at the expense of the center, which loses it. The band moves outward and cools and condenses. The condensing ices and dust first form planetesimals, little dinky planets, and then these gradually collide and adhere to form planets. The planets rotate around the sun in one plane, aligned with the sun's equator, revolving in the same direction as the sun itself revolves. Interior radioactive decay, pressure and meteorite bombardment heat up the planets, inner planets particularly, driving out the gases inside. That's the theory. Is there any evidence for this theory? Well, it fits the data we sketched above, as it was designed to do. No other known theory does as well. It also explains irregularities in this data, such as non-circular orbits in some cases, or a planet that's axis is tilted rather substantially, or that sort of thing. It predicts that planets will be common, as now seems to be the case. It predicts that planet formation is still going on, as also seems to be so. That's the scientific data, and the model which best fits that scientific data as the best one so far as we know. Now let's take a look at the biblical data. And does this fit with Genesis 1? Well, this model doesn't seem to fit very well with the traditional interpretation of Genesis 1, but the traditional interpretation was made by people who didn't know the science. it doesn't follow that the model doesn't fit what the Genesis account actually says, and that's going to be our proposal here. Let's see. We're going to look at what the biblical text says in the Hebrew. We'll try and see if it can be understood in harmony with solid scientific data, since God is the author of both nature and scripture. Okay, let's look at the first section, Genesis 1, 1 through 5. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. The Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning one day. We see here a beginning when God created. We see that the earth is initially formless and empty, and yet the solar system was formed from an amorphous gas cloud, formless and empty, without form, void. Darkness, as the gas cloud collapses, it will become denser and darker within. A helpful way of viewing the Genesis account is to ask ourselves, what is the point of view that the reader is asked to take, so to speak, by the author? And my suggestion is the reader is imagined as viewing what is going on from the surface of what will be the earth. Obviously, until you get a solid earth, this would just be a piece of some of the stuff floating around. So the observer will be inside the gas cloud, not outside looking in, as we might imagine, a God's eye view, but sort of a human observer's eye view, if you like. So as the cloud collapses, it becomes denser and darker until it's dark everywhere around. Then, as the cloud begins to ionize, the cloud begins to glow, and it's light everywhere around. Now the equatorial band is pushed outside the glow. And the rotating planets, as they're formed, will have a day-night sequence. So as one is pushed outside the glow, you will see a separation between light and darkness. And you will see the light that you see will now be daylight. You're on a planet, and you're on the sun side of that planet, it's day, and then you're on the night side of that planet, and it's night, etc. Genesis 1, 6 through 8. And God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it, and it was so. God called the expanse sky, and there was evening and there was morning, a second day. An expanse is formed to separate the waters. This is the atmosphere. Some people have claimed that this object called the firmament in the King James is a solid dome. I've tried to deal with this in one of our PowerPoint talks, the biblical firmament, vault, or vapor, so I refer you to that. An expanse is formed to separate the waters, the atmosphere. This expanse forms our blue sky. No need to see it as a solid dome. No need to have the waters above be outside our atmosphere. As I show in the talk on the biblical firmament, the way the Hebrew uses prepositions with tenuous objects is such that the waters above, if you like, would be waters supported by the atmosphere, what we think of as clouds. The order, by the way, fits the scientific view regarding outgassing, an expanse formed after the planet, and this expanse forms the sky, and this expanse separates out the atmospheric water from the surface water. Job 38, verses 8 and 9 seems to be talking of the same events from a somewhat different perspective when God asked Job, "Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness?" A picture here of the birth of the ocean, if you like, and it's swathed in clouds and darkness. God is here speaking to Job in poetic language about the birth of the oceans. The womb is apparently the earth, just as a scientific outgassing model suggests.
The earth was then cloud-covered and dark, suggesting when harmonized with Genesis 1, the simultaneous formation of atmosphere and ocean. We move on to Genesis 1, 9 and 10. And God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered into one place. Let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered water seas. God saw that it was good. We now know that Earth's surface is made up of great thin plates of crust moving slowly on the mantle beneath the whole continental drift or plate tectonics model. We know that there are two types of crust. There's the light, thick continental crust, which floats on a thinner crust, and there's the heavy, thin ocean basin crust. It looks like that the oceans drain off into the basins when the crust splits into these two kinds. And one could construct various scenarios for that. My understanding of the geology is that the continental crust is formed by a volcanism and then sweeping this stuff together with plate movement, etc., to form these higher masses, these higher structures, which kind of float on the thinner crust, like ice cubes would float on the surface of water. Genesis 1:11 through 13, then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, and God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning a third day. Naturally, there's no land vegetation without land to have it on. The order, however, is interesting here. Plants are narrated before animals, and we now know that animals depend upon plants. Plants are narrated before the sun, moon, and stars, seen as contradicting science. And both younger creationists and various types of atheistic evolutionists have seen this as a contradiction between the Bible and science, and the younger creationists say the science is wrong, and the evolutionists say the Bible is wrong, but I think they're wrong. I think basically we have something very striking going on here, something more subtle. We'll see about that in just a moment. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 14 through 19, we have this account. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. Let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light upon the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to dominate the day, the lesser light to dominate the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to dominate the day and night, separate light from darkness. God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. Here again, the account is being written from the perspective for the viewpoint of a Earth-based observer. And so stars are not so big a deal as the two great lights. The great light that dominates the day, the sun, and the lesser light, which can only dominate the night, because when the sun's up, the sun dominates. And yet both of them are brighter than the stars. That's a Earth surface viewpoint of the matter. My suggestion is we're getting the same in the appearance of these objects, namely that before this point the atmosphere was clouded and you couldn't see these objects, even though it was the sun that was causing the day and the night from the surface of the Earth. You couldn't see it, but now God causes these objects to appear by clearing the atmosphere. Though often overlooked, this fits science very well. Viewed from Earth, this describes the clearing of the atmosphere so that the sun, moon, and stars become visible. This clearing is the direct result of vegetation, mentioned the previous day, which removes carbon dioxide and replaces it with oxygen. So, here's how it looks. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, is the biblical statement. Scientifically, a beginning, the Big Bang, perhaps. The earth is formless and empty, says the Bible, The Earth is an amorphous, tenuous gas cloud. There's darkness on the face of the deep. After contraction, the gas cloud becomes dark. God says, let there be light. Further contraction, and the cloud begins to glow. The light is divided from darkness. The planetary material is thrust outside, so the observer now sees not light everywhere, but light over where the sun is being formed, and darkness off in the other directions, separation. The light is called day, and the darkness is called night, because we now have planet form from the planetesimals, and the day side of the planet, the side of the planet facing the sun is light, and that's day, and the side facing away is dark, and that's night. So the sun and rotation give day and night. The waters burst forth from the womb of the earth. An expanse appears in the middle of midst of the waters, a combination of the Job and the Genesis passages. Heating the earth drives out the water and gases. Division of waters above and below. The atmosphere allows both surface and atmospheric water. Gathering of the waters, a dry land appears. Development of the continental crust and ocean basins, and they running off of the water. Huh? The earth brings forth vegetation. Land vegetation appears. Lights appear in the sky to mark all days, seasons, and years. Sun and moon dominate the day and night. Photosynthesis by the vegetation replaces the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by oxygen, lowering the temperature and clearing the atmosphere so that stars, etc., are visible. It also prepares the atmosphere for animals and humans. Well, to pull this all together, a reasonable interpretation of the biblical and scientific data is consistent in a striking, non-trivial way. The correlation between Genesis 1 and science is much better than between Genesis and other ancient creation accounts, or between science and other ancient creation accounts. We suggest this is so because the Creator is the author of Genesis. Further reading, we suggest our book, Genesis 1, and the Origin of the Earth. We suggest John Wiester's book, The Genesis Connection. We suggest Hugh Ross's book, The Creator and the Cosmos. We hope these will be helpful for your further study.